Hello everyone, I'm Matthew, I'm the lead pastor here at Cedar Ridge. I want to welcome you again to our service this morning. Thank you so much for joining us. It's great to be together. We're in week two today of our series On the Trail with Jesus, and we're going on this virtual hike on a present day trail in northern Israel, which goes from Jesus's hometown of Nazareth to a town called Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee, which is where he moved later in life. And just to sort of orient us to that geography, here's a map of Israel in Jesus's time. You'll see in the top right there, the Sea of Galilee. And a little bit further over to the west, you'll see Nazareth, where the trail begins, sort of in the top middle part of that map. And then to sort of locate us in the present day, here's the trail, the Jesus Trail, as it's called, begins in Nazareth in the west and then heads northeast up to Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee. Today, we're going to cover the section from Cana to Lavi. And you may remember that Ruth left us in Cana last week, talking about the famous miracle of Jesus turning water into wine. So we're going to trek along from there to Lavi. It's a really beautiful section of the trail. Lots of beautiful countryside, lots of rich agricultural land. Not so many specific stop-off points as perhaps some of the other parts of the trail. You know, not so many aspects or locations on the trail that are specifically necessarily related to stories about Jesus. But Jesus would inevitably have walked at least parts of this trail with his followers. Perhaps many times. And, you know, of course, this journey is not, we're going on the journey not only to try and sort of root ourselves in the history and geography and culture of the area and sort of reflect perhaps in light of those freshly on the teachings of Jesus, but we also see this journey as a metaphor for our own spiritual lives, our own spiritual journey. So we're going on this trail together. We're going to take a quick look at the trail now, and you may remember from last week that we've been going along with Betsy and Philip, who are two young people that made a decision to walk the trail as realistically as they could. They even dress up in first century Palestinian garb, which makes them look a little bit eccentric. You know, they look like they may have escaped from a Christmas pageant or something like that. And they certainly get a few interesting looks from people along the way. But they're just trying to root themselves in that history. And as they go along, as we'll see in the clip from today, they try to do it the way Jesus would have done it, as close as possible, not just the way they dress, but in terms of the food they eat and how they prepare and cook that food, and live the kind of simple life that Jesus would have lived with his followers. So let's take a look at the trail now, and then we'll draw some conclusions and some applications for the journey that they're on.
But the whole trail up to Illinois, we went through kind of some back country, and it was just beautiful out. It felt like you were out in the middle of nowhere. There was no sounds except wilderness sounds and huge fields of green grass, and it was just a really beautiful experience. One of the best feelings was arriving at Illinois Goat Farm and near Golani Junction, where we're staying the night. The sun was at a perfect angle, the grass was green, there are flowers and gardens everywhere, and goats and frogs, and somebody driving their sheep home at night. It just felt like a moment of paradise. You know, you're tired and your feet are dirty, and you come to this place where there's soft green grass, you know, like in Psalm 23. In just a few minutes, we need to start a fire so that we can make supper for the crew here and ourselves. Last night we had brown lentil stew. Tonight we're going to have red lentil stew with bulgur and some goat cheese from this amazing goat farm and bread from a local bakery in Nazareth.
It's like an example, and I think yesterday they had a chance to see how things used to be.
Those days,
exactly, and I don't think it was that easy. Correct me if I'm wrong.
When you go in the costume, I think you feel different. You are not a hiker, you're part of a story. Yeah. And I think this is what Jesus is all about, to be part of a story of what Jesus done 2,000 years ago. And it's very exciting, even for us as a Jews, to see this experience and these people that are want to go in Jesus' footprints?
Don't give up.
Just beyond Golani Junction. So behind us is a Roman road, which would have gone from Akko on the coast all the way to Tiberias. And so we're kind of going in the right direction, I guess. Jesus very likely would have walked this road to get to the Sea of Galilee himself.
It's been very doable. I think there are challenges. It's hard to get rid of plastic, and we find that we still have to use certain things, matches sometimes.
This morning was really funny just over here at Golani Junction, seeing people's reactions. My favorite was this whole bus of kids, and they were all waving at us like as they were going through the stoplight, so that was fun. We waved back.
I think one of the most interesting parts of their walk will probably be when they cross the Roman roads, because then it's like they're dressed in antiquity, and then they're like actual walking on Roman roads that could have been part of the same actual road, and so it's just kind of, I don't know, I kind of think of that as a pinnacle of where the two stories will kind of meet.
So three main things stand out about this part of the trail, and we're going to touch on each of them today and look at some context and try and make some applications into our own life. The first thing is the natural beauty of the area. Just not that many stop-off points along the trail compared to other sections of the trail, but just the whole area is just beautiful in terms of both the cultivated and uncultivated land. We'll explore that a little bit. The Roman road is a feature of this part, a piece of ancient history there. And then we have this idyllic community of Ilania, where they stop off at the goat farm and the eco lodge. So we'll take a little look at that community. There's also another community at the end of this section in La Vie, which is an Orthodox kibbutz. That doesn't feature in the video. We'll make a few comments about it though as we go through. So first of all, this the beauty of nature in this stretch of the trail, and many other parts of the trail are phenomenally beautiful as well. But this is a very agricultural area, and Jesus, of course, was rooted in his agricultural context. You know, Jesus was connected to nature in ways that we probably aren't today. You know, we're somewhat buffered from nature, but certainly buffered from the agricultural world. Jesus was very much rooted and grounded in that context. He wasn't a farmer, but he experienced agricultural life, and we see that in all the examples that he used of for, you know, metaphors and analogies, and with his parables and stories. He was constantly using agricultural examples, whether it's seeds or weeds or harvesting, whatever it was. And of course, when he wanted to talk about a subject like anxiety, for instance, he said, look at the flowers of the field, look at the birds of the air. Jesus was very much connected to nature. And I think it's fair to say that for Jesus, nature represents God. God speaks through nature. And you know, we talk a lot about nature here. And I'm not in any way saying that we all should be tree huggers or in nature 24/7, but you know, it's not everybody's cup of tea. But I think our separation from nature, our separation from agriculture, may mean we miss out on some of the experience of God that that Jesus had. So as we're following this trail with Jesus, we want to look at what was it like for Jesus. And I just want to suggest three ways in which Jesus's connection to the natural world, and by extension, our potential connection to the natural world, can help us experience God. The first one is God is present in the natural world. If we want to experience God, we can experience God through nature. Not the only way we experience God, but it's a very definite way. For Jesus, God speaks through nature. There's a wisdom to nature, the sort of flow and the ebb of nature, and its longevity and its cyclical nature. I think Jesus draws on the depth of that wisdom from nature, and the beauty of nature that Jesus has, I think, this sense of awe and enjoyment about the natural world and the agricultural world that goes beyond just physical or visual beauty. So Jesus loves eating the product of agriculture and drinking the product of agriculture. We saw last week how he turns water into wine. I think Jesus really enjoys food and drink, and especially eating and drinking with his friends. He also ate and drank with his enemies. I mean, that was part of the culture back then. Eating and drinking together was a sense, was a form of community. But you get the impression Jesus, along this trail, would have stopped off and eaten when he was able to. We get the I think in this video that we saw, the sense of that was a bit of a struggle at times. We'll get to that. Because, you know, preparing food and cooking food wasn't as easy as it is today. But Jesus really enjoyed it and experienced community and experienced God through that community because of his connection to the agricultural world. Secondly, nature shows us that we're not in control. Jesus would have been subject to weather patterns, floods and winds and earthquakes, destructive forces that can really upset the culture and upset the situation for a lot of people and inhibit agriculture. So there would have been scarcity of food at times. Jesus would have known what it was like to go hungry. And there was this sense that you can't just take everything for granted. I mean, we're, again, somewhat buffered from that right now, I think, in our modern world. We can protect ourselves from the elements. We can have food, different types of food, out of season. There's, for many of us, we have an abundance of food, easy access to food. That's not true for everybody, of course, in this country or around the world. But in our modern life, we might be lulled into a false sense of security and we have the illusion of control. But when we think about it, big picture, global warming and the kind of wildfires and storms and flooding that we're experiencing, they just show us that we're not in control of nature. It's an illusion. And likewise with food, there are times when we do experience scarcity. For instance, beginning of the lockdown of the pandemic last year, there was a rush on food, but people were worried that wouldn't be enough food. So interestingly, the human response to scarcity is fear and a move to try and control our circumstances by hoarding food rather than thinking about sharing it and making sure that everybody has enough. So we may think we're in control, and our separation from nature and agriculture may give us the illusion of control, but actually nature tells us that we're not in control. And actually that's a good thing, because that makes us more interdependent. It makes us dependent on God for provision. It makes us dependent on one another, other people who prepare food, who grow food, who harvest food. We when we're connected to it rather than buffered from it, we see the fact that we need one another. And I'm a shameless plug here for our community farm. This coming Friday, we have another sangria night. Come on out to the farm, either on a Friday or on a Thursday night, from 6 to 8 p.m. And experience what it's like actually growing food and the joy of that, the struggle of that. We have a real live opportunity to connect with God in that way, and in a way that would be much more like the experience of Jesus than our modern day experience. And then thirdly, nature speaks to us about partnership with God. In other words, agriculture is this incredible partnership with life, isn't it? Where the mystery of life is all around us, things growing, things reproducing. But we've been able to work with that and cultivate certain crops that didn't exist, because we've adapted them before humanity. We've adapted them to our needs, and we're co-creators with God. We're working in partnership with God and creation. And that's something that Jesus was always talking about, partnership with God, inviting us to work with God, that God believes in us, God trusts us, God wants us to be agents of love, peace, and hope, to bring renewal, to bring healing to the world. We get to do that work, and that's a beautiful thing. All this sort of leads to the conclusion, I think, that God loves the physical world. God loves the natural world. And rather than it being a sort of a secondary thing to some separate spiritual world, and in fact some religious thought would suggest that the world's going to be destroyed, God really doesn't like it and will destroy it one day. Whereas I don't think scripture speaks about that. In Romans chapter 8, the Apostle Paul says, we know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up until the present time. In other words, it's about renewal. Something new is coming. It hasn't come to fruition yet. Nature isn't, it's like it hasn't fully blossomed. And the future looks like a future of renewal and construction and partnership. In the book of Revelation, that sort of, you know, an apocalyptic vision, let's call it. It's a poem. It's metaphorical. I think we've got to be careful about taking it all literally. But in chapter 21, it says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away." Very often, Revelation is where people go to try and work out what's going to happen at the end of the world. Well, it looks like it's renewed, it's restored, it's not destroyed. It's there's something beautiful and recreative that happens within this physical world. So God loves the physical world, and Jesus was very connected to it, experienced God through it, and shared that with other people as well. Let's talk a little bit about the Roman road. So here's a road that Jesus may well have walked on. It's been excavated, and the Romans, of course, were famous for their roads. It's incredible technology. They were able to build these roads that meant people could travel along them. There was all kinds of commerce and trade that could happen, and generation of wealth. It really transformed the culture around them. Exchange of ideas. It was just many positive things happened through the Roman roads. And they were, but there's a sinister aspect to it. There's a dark aspect to these roads, because we know they're part of the Roman Empire. Ruth talked about the Roman Empire last week and its will to dominate and control and suppress. And anybody who rebelled against it was put down brutally. And these roads, in some respects, for me at least, they represent technology that was used to oppress. It's like a blight on this idyllic countryside, and the roads were constructed in very efficient utilitarian kinds of ways. They went from A to B in a straight line primarily. Here's a picture of another road, Roman road in Great Britain, actually, because they built them all over their empire. And they were very efficient, but they didn't cooperate with nature. They subjugated nature. They were just like a blight on the surface of nature. And we also know, of course, that their intention wasn't really to create wealth for everybody and to spread wonderful ideas. It was to spread Roman ideas and primarily to transport armies around their empire so that they could keep control of people and subjugate people. And so the Roman road represents the closeness, I would say, of injustice and oppression that Jesus experienced. Many of us, not all of us, many of us might be somewhat buffered from injustice. We may not experience that firsthand. We read about it, we hear about it, but we're not necessarily experiencing it in the way that Jesus did. And so we're just going to explore that a little bit as we want to walk this trail with Jesus, and experience the things that Jesus experienced as we walk in his footsteps. We're just going to explore that a little bit in the community of Ilania. Now, Ilania, which is the point where they stop and they cook some dinner and they're on the goat farm and the eco lodge. The community of Ilania is a really interesting one, because it's set in this idyllic scene. And there's a, and even the way it's portrayed in that video is somewhat idyllic. But I think it represents in many ways the tensions of the idyllic natural world and the Roman road, imperialism and suppression and oppression, the dark side of humanity, if you like. What happened in the early part of the 20th century was that people started migrating from primarily Russia and Kurdistan, Jewish people, who many of whom were fleeing oppression. And they established a community, which they called Sedjera, in this what is now Ilania. And that community, it's now about 300 people. It's never been really huge. It's one of the first settlements in the Lower Galilee. And it was established on land bought by Baron Edmund James de Rothschild, famous French Jewish person who, from a very famous family, a banker, had a lot of money and bought up a lot of land in Palestine, especially with a view to creating a home for Jewish people who were fleeing all sorts of things in the early part of the 20th century. Eventually, the land was transferred to the Jewish Colonization Association. The community was built next to a pre-existent Arab community called Al-Shajara, and those two names are very similar. Sejira was named after Al-Shajara and eventually became known as Ilania. Al-Shajara and Sejira, the two communities, Jewish and Arab, lived quite harmoniously in the first part of the 20th century. Life seemed to be pretty good, certainly better than previous experiences they'd had. Until the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. At that point, the Israeli military depopulated Al-Shajara and the Arab people were forced off the land. And so it represents, in the history, is represented violence and the cycle of violence and oppression. The oppressed become the oppressor. And obviously the Israel-Palestine situation is very complicated and very political, and I'm not going to unpack that whole thing today. But suffice it to say that I think hidden away behind the comfort and the ideal of the community of Ilania is a story of injustice and a story of oppression. There's still a military base, an Israeli military base, right next to Ilania, which doesn't get a mention in that video, doesn't get a mention actually on the Jesus Trail website, but representative of that action that took place, that injustice when people were forcibly moved off their land in 1948. We have a whole history represented here that dates back to the time of Jesus and beyond. After Jesus's time, for the remainder of the Roman Empire, there was such awful oppression and suppression that this area of Palestine became depopulated with Jewish people, and other groups moved in. And then throughout the history of the Middle Ages, with the Crusades and oppression of Jewish people in European cities, and forcibly thrown out at times, and then later the pogroms and the eventually the Holocaust in Germany, just unbelievable atrocities and injustices committed against Jewish people. There was a movement over the years of Jewish people back into this territory. And again, initially, it wasn't violent, it wasn't oppressive. It was there was a lot of cooperation, a lot of working together, Jewish people side by side with Arab people. With the rise of Zionism and the eventual foundation of the State of Israel, under the control of other empires, for instance, at the end of the Second World War, the area transferred power was transferred from the Ottoman Empire to become a mandate of the British Empire. These empires vying for control and dominance of this area really wreaked havoc, and with the decisions to create a State of Israel because of so much persecution in the 20th century, and especially the Holocaust, the creation of the State of Israel was intended to be peaceful. It was intended to be cooperative, but it resulted in violence perpetrated against Arab people, and then we've had the Arab-Israeli conflict ever since then. Again, complicated, difficult history, difficult story. It's replicated in the that community of Lavi that I was telling you about, that Orthodox kibbutz at the end of this part of the trail. That was a community established by refugees from Great Britain, actually, Jewish refugees from Britain in the early part of the 20th century, and established next to an Arab community. And then in 1948, that Arab community was depopulated. So we have that. There's a memorial actually to the Holocaust at Lavi. So you have the sense of people being oppressed, but also oppressing others. And it's a complicated, difficult history and difficult story. The reason I want to bring it up today is because I want to ask ourselves three questions around this issue of injustice. And we talk a lot about nature. We also talk a lot about injustice. But Jesus walked really close to injustice. And when we listen to Jesus's teachings about breaking the cycle of violence that has been going on in this area since then, time and time again, we've just heard about that cycle, violence begetting violence. When we when we think about Jesus's teaching, when we're listening to Jesus's teaching, he's saying that in a context of unbelievable oppression, the Roman road representing that. He's walking that road. He's walking really close to it all. And this is very real. And Jesus is bringing hope and light into the darkness, into the cycle of violence. And perhaps we've never really taken Jesus seriously. Perhaps we've never dreamed it could be possible. And we're just resigned to the fact that when violence is committed against people, those people very often commit violence against others, and the cycle will be repeated. I look, though, with hope to people like Howard Thurman, Martin Luther King, who took the teachings of Jesus seriously, and influenced by many other people too, but primarily for them, as followers of Jesus, they took the teaching of Jesus seriously and said, we don't just want to create another cycle. We're going to pursue nonviolence in the way of Jesus. And they got that from Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount. In chapter 5, it says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? So here Jesus is telling us that it's possible to find a way out of this cycle of violence. And, you know, I think we listen to that and it's we've heard it before. We talk about this a lot, right? And it sounds nice, and it sort of sounds like a platitude. It sounds like an ideal, but can we pursue it? Can we make it a reality? Is there any hope for humanity to break out of this cycle of violence and oppression? Jesus is saying yes. And it's Jesus saying yes in a context of violence and oppression. He's not being idealistic about it. And I think in Ilania, this community, we have kind of a visual image, if you like, on this trail of the idyllic scenario, the idyllic setting, somewhat buffering us from the history, from the injustice that has been perpetrated. Okay, there was another community that existed there 60, 70 years ago, and it's been depopulated, and that's not right. Doesn't matter how idyllic it may seem now. In fact, the ideal or idyllic nature of the existence there now can perhaps buffer us from that history of injustice. And that might be true in our own lives. We might be buffered from injustice. We may not experience injustice the way some people do. And because of that, we're not as tuned into it, and it's not as deep a concern for us, but it's a deep concern for Jesus. This is what Jesus wants to do. This is what Jesus is bringing us to partner with God and being agents of love, peace, and hope. So it's very hopeful, but it's a huge struggle. And so I just want to ask three questions as we reflect on this, as we, if you like, we walk the road of love with Jesus. And the first question is this: in what ways do we seek to dominate in our own lives? And, you know, we may not feel, we're not Roman emperors, we're not centurions, we're not commanders of armies and that kind of thing, but in our relationships, in our communication, in the way we handle ourselves, are we behaving compassionately, tenderly, gently? Are we communicating out of love? Are we seeking to be to understand before we're seeking to be understood? Are we trying to control and manipulate? Again, I'm not accusing either myself or anybody of this, but just saying, could we honestly reflect on this in light of Jesus's teaching? Now, I don't think Jesus is in any way saying you need to be, you know, let people walk all over you, or just be nice, just keep the peace. I don't think Jesus is saying that at all. In fact, in Matthew 10, Jesus says, do not suppose that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. That could be dangerously misinterpreted as Jesus advocating violence. But Jesus is clearly using hyperbole and metaphor to say, if you follow me, you're going to make life uncomfortable, both for yourself and probably some people around you. You know, you're going to bring the sword of the word, the sword of nonviolent resistance into situations that's going to may even cost you your life, like it cost Jesus. That may create pain and difficulty initially on this pathway, on this trail to peace and justice. So it's not about being a pushover, and nonviolence is active, it's intentional, it's courageous, it's way more courageous than violence. So this is not about being walked over or pushed around, but you know, whether it's bullying tactics or passive aggressive tactics, could we examine our own lives and think, like, in what way do we need to walk this road of love with Jesus more in our everyday relationships and our everyday encounters? So that's one question for us to reflect on. Secondly, does our desire for comfort inhibit our willingness to face injustice? So we just talked there about Jesus saying, you know, it's going to be, if you follow me, it's going to be uncomfortable. I think we're almost addicted to comfort, though, in our culture. I know I am. I don't like to rock the boat. I don't particularly like change. I certainly don't want to have to face my wrongdoings or even engage with my guilt. And so when it comes to injustice, it's very easy for me to explain it away, to buffer myself from it in a way that Jesus didn't or couldn't, because Jesus lived with it. And for many of us, we can't buffer it. We can't separate ourselves from injustice because we are subject to injustice. Many of us are subject to racial injustice in our culture, and we can't escape it. But people like me have the privilege of being able to escape it. But are we willing to face it? Are we willing to go to that uncomfortable place? Are we willing to listen to the cry of the oppressed, to people who are saying, I am oppressed, I'm experiencing oppression, I'm experiencing injustice? Can we empathetically listen and engage rather than running away, rather than explaining away? And obviously we're on this journey together as a church, and that's an uncomfortable journey. And even talking about it is uncomfortable, but let's be courageous. Let's transcend our politics and our political affiliations, and as we follow Jesus to pursue justice, be willing to go to a place of discomfort. So let's ask ourselves that question. Just like there's certain comforts in the community of Ilyana, are we hiding behind that comfort and instead of coming out from it and embracing the call of Jesus for justice? And then finally, we can't change the past. None of us can do that. But can we take ownership? And there's this tragic history to the areas we're walking on this trail this week. Some of it's hidden, some of it's more obvious. If you walk past that military base, it'll be more obvious. But in Ilyana and maybe even in Lviv, it's not so obvious immediately. But there's this tragic history that's the backdrop to this trail. And again, Jesus comes to this tragedy with hope, with a call to be agents of love, peace, and hope, to break the cycle of violence. But I think to do that, we have to own that history. I say that as a British person who comes from a country where people would just get on a boat, go anywhere in the world, and put a flag in the ground and say, right, this is ours now, and start moving people off the land and oppressing people and enslaving people. And so, we have to come to the terms as British people with empire. And I think until we come to terms with it, until we own it, it's very difficult for people to take us seriously in that we really want to do something about it. It's like if you have an argument with somebody or somebody has wronged you, you don't just want to hear, oh, sorry, you know, sorry about that. You want to hear someone say, I realize what happened. I realize what I did, and I'm taking ownership of that. When somebody does that, the likelihood of change happening is much higher. And so for reconciliation to happen, there has to be some kind of ownership, especially as we think about empire and colonialism and racism, racial injustice, there has to be some ownership. And we, the temptation, I think, for people like me, especially for white people, is to think, well, I didn't perpetrate that injustice. I wasn't there. That's not my history. That's not my story. And we kind of remove ourselves from it in a way that is inappropriately disowning it. And, you know, somebody used and gave me this analogy. I don't know where they got it from. It's not an original thought, but they likened it to owning a house that's been passed down through generations from family to family, you know, to, within the same family. And by the time we inherit it, it's broken down, it's rat infested, it's got all kinds of problems with it. And we could just say, not our problem, you know, point the finger at the previous generations and say, well, they did it, that's what they did. But it's our house, we own it, it's ours. And so we have to take ownership, we have to do something about it. And that was a helpful analogy to me of not about blame. It's not about just trying to feel guilty and that maybe will sort of be a salve to us or something like that, but saying, no, there's history here, there's a story here. We need to know the story. We need to understand the story in order for us to be able to move forward and make amends and to repair the breach and to bring healing and to bring reconciliation. So, you know, our tendency is not to go to that place of discomfort. We just let history be a buffer. Maybe let our comfort levels in life now just soothe us into inaction. But that's not the way of Jesus. That's not the road that Jesus trod. That's not the trail that we're walking on with Jesus. So again, I offer these as questions, not in any way accusing anybody, but put them out there as challenges that I personally want to reflect on. And as we come to communion now, we're going to leave these questions up. And let's just take a moment of silence to reflect on them. Invite Jesus to challenge us in our own lives. And then we'll eat the bread and drink the wine together as we take communion.